recently the 10,000th APTC student graduated from the APTC in Fiji, and the six-year, $192 million aid investment extension is due to commence in July 2018. We appreciate the contributions of how APTC can be refashioned to ensure more students graduate while also being mindful of brain drain risks. And my thanks go to Stephen from the Development Policy Centre for being part of a high-level design reference group in the lead-up to the design mission that's now underway. Now, the government's also advancing regional labour mobility integration through ongoing negotiations on the Pacific Agreement on Closer Economic Relations, PACER Plus. Now, PACER Plus contains a chapter through which Australia will make commitments to facilitate the movement of certain skilled workers. Noting the Pacific Island countries' key interest in labour mobility, during the PACER Plus negotiations, a separate labour mobility arrangement was agreed with Pacific countries, Australia and New Zealand, in August last year. Now, this arrangement creates a framework for labour mobility cooperation. Importantly, we'll establish a new Pacific Labour Mobility annual meeting to discuss the region's labour mobility initiatives, policies and priorities. Now, after that little ad from me, we have about 90 minutes, so we'll go to 4:50. So 75 minutes, sorry, I'll make that now, with the late start. So we'll have three presentations, about 15 minutes each, and then we'll have questions and answers. Okay, so the first paper from Richard Curtin, Stephen Howes and Henry Sherrill on backpackers versus seasonal workers learning from Australia, learning from Australia's and New Zealand's contrasting experiences. I think it's an interesting one, but to present this, we'll have Matthew Dornan, who is intimately involved, I'm sure, with the paper's preparation as well. And then we'll have, looking at transition livelihoods, we'll have a look at the Timorese migrant work experience in the UK with Anne Wigglesworth, and then look at enhancing the development impact, absolutely critical aspect of labour mobility, with Elise Holani following that. So Matt, over to you.
Great. I might just begin without a PowerPoint, and if it doesn't get going, so be it. So apologies for the confusion. I'm actually the fourth author of this paper, and for reasons that I won't go into, I was left off the original program. I wasn't due to present, though, but we had a last-minute change. So I am presenting this, but this very much is a collaborative effort between the four of us. So I do want to acknowledge the work of my co-authors. The slides that I'm presenting today are very much based on those that Henry Sherrill... Sorry? Ah. You've got it? Okay. All right, I'll wouldn't be this. I'll let you... Henry Sherrill presented an earlier version of this paper at the Migration at Work conference at the University of Sydney recently. And of course, the findings that we're presenting in this paper are really based on years of research undertaken by the likes of Stephen Howes and Richard Curtin, as well as others at the Development Policy Centre. I'm not sure if Stephen will come in later, but regardless, I'll invite Henry to join me at the end to help answer questions. Rob's already spoken about the potential development impacts of labour mobility on Pacific Islanders, so I don't want to discuss that in any detail, but suffice to say that has really driven the Centre's interest in the seasonal worker program. It hasn't only driven our interest, it's also driven DFAT's interest, and DFAT has been a real champion for the seasonal worker program. If you want to read about those development impacts, then Gibson and McKenzie have done quite a lot of work on this. Still not working. Anyway. Now, what we do in this paper is we compare the Australian seasonal worker program with the equivalent scheme in New Zealand. So the New Zealand recognised RSE scheme, recognised seasonal employer scam. Sorry. Is that working? No.
Hey, I'm here.
Excellent. Thanks, Micah. I've got charts to show as well. And it's important to note here that the schemes have really differed in their take-up and as a result in their impact. The number of workers participating in the New Zealand scheme is approximately... excellent. Thank you very much, Michael.
No worries.
So the number of workers participating in the New Zealand scheme are roughly double those participating in the Australian scheme. And those differences enable us to test what is a widely accepted argument in the migration literature, that of the crowding out hypothesis. So this idea that poorly regulated temporary migration schemes will crowd out better regulated migration schemes. The basis for that argument is the idea that employers prefer low-cost labour, that they're out to make a profit. Frank Castles, a leading migration expert who's been based at the University of Sydney, is one of the proponents of this crowding out hypothesis. And the experience with the seasonal worker program in Australia provides some support to that argument. However, the New Zealand experience with its seasonal worker program does not. So a regulated labour supply of temporary migrants has really thrived in New Zealand horticulture, contrary to the expectations of this crowding out hypothesis. So the question that we address in this paper is, why is that the case, and why are these contrasting outcomes between the Australian scheme and the New Zealand scheme? And to answer that, we need to look at the history of migration policy in both countries. So the migration policies in both countries do share a lot in common. Both prioritise permanent settler migration while maintaining anti-Asian policies through to the 1970s. Both countries assisted new migrants in a bid to expand their population base. One major difference between the two countries is treatment of Pacific Islanders. So New Zealand's history, it introduced special migration windows for Pacific Islanders in 1975. And no such windows were introduced in Australia. So as a result, of course, New Zealand has a large Pacific Islander diaspora population, around 7% of the total. In Australia, it's never reached 1%. The migration policies of both countries have traditionally emphasised permanent migration. However, more recently, that has changed, and there's been a growing interest in temporary migration schemes. The main focus of those has been skilled migration. So in Australia, the 457 visa, which has, of course, attracted a lot of attention in the press in recent years, and in New Zealand, the essential skill visa. That said, there's convincing evidence that other temporary migration channels have operated as de facto low-skilled migration windows. In Australia, for example, Bushur argues that student visas and backpacker visas have constituted those de facto low-skilled programs. In relation to horticulture, both countries introduced temporary migration windows in the mid-2000s. And this was done for a similar reason in both cases. So it was done to address shortages of labour in the horticulture sector. So the Recognised Seasonal Employer Program, the RSE program in New Zealand, and the Seasonal Worker Program in Australia, they're fairly similar schemes. Both are much more heavily regulated than alternative sources of labour in horticulture, such as backpackers, irregular migrants, and also natives or citizens. However, the way in which these schemes were introduced did differ. And so did the context or the horticulture industry in each country. Employment of citizens is much more important in New Zealand horticulture than in Australia, and you can see that in the percentages on the graph. There's also anecdotal evidence that illegal labour is more widespread in Australia than in New Zealand. And part of that is due to enforcement. There's been a more active enforcement in New Zealand of regulations than there has been in Australia. And the other key difference is the employment of backpackers in the horticulture sector. And I'll talk about that shortly. As I mentioned before, the Australian and New Zealand seasonal worker schemes similar in design, so employers who want to employ seasonal workers in both countries must obtain approval from government. They must engage in labour market testing, advertising for job vacancies, for example. They must meet pastoral care responsibilities, such as the provision of accommodation. They must help with certain costs, such as travel costs. The New Zealand scheme has always been capped, and that cap has slowly increased over time, and the cap is the number in the brackets. The Australian scheme was initially capped, and in 2015 that cap was removed. Despite these differences, the schemes have shown very different trajectories, and again you can see that in this table. So the New Zealand scheme quickly reached its cap, and it has since increased in line with those modest the expansions in the cap. The Australian scheme, in contrast, has taken much longer to grow to a reasonable size, and as I said earlier, even now it's only half the size of the New Zealand program. The limited take-up of the seasonal worker program in Australia really lends support to the claim that employers prefer unregulated and irregular workers. In other words, it lends support to that crowding out hypothesis that I mentioned earlier. The New Zealand scheme contradicts that claim. The number of seasonal workers in this graph is compared with an estimate of the number of backpackers working in horticulture in each country. So seasonal workers in New Zealand and Australia are shown by the solid lines. So this line here and this line here. The black is for New Zealand and light blue is for Australia. The number of backpackers working in the horticulture industry, it's an estimate based on the take-up of second-year visas. In Australia, it's this dashed light blue line, and in New Zealand, it's this dashed black line. And the graph, it basically shows a fairly convincing explanation for why the number of seasonal workers in Australia has been limited relative to that in New Zealand. Farmers in Australia, in short, have opted to employ backpackers as opposed to seasonal workers. Now, those decisions of individual farmers were really influenced by changes to migration policy, which affected the supply of labour from backpackers. So in 2005, the Howard government, in response to lobbying from the National Farmers Federation and other industry groups, it introduced a second-year working holiday maker visa extension, and that was available to first-year visa holders who did at least 3 months of regional work. That decision really transformed the Australian horticulture labour market as backpackers under the working holiday maker visa actively chose horticultural employment as a means to seek additional residency. The same change didn't occur in New Zealand. So in New Zealand in 2009 there was an extension that was put in place, but it was an extension of 3 months only, whereas in Australia the extension was for 1 year. And importantly in New Zealand, that extension was put in place after the RSC scheme had already achieved considerable success and farmers were already using those seasonal workers. So I've pointed to one of the key reasons that the New Zealand scheme has been comparatively more successful than the Australian scheme. There are other explanations though. One is the export orientation of horticulture in New Zealand. So in New Zealand, a large proportion of horticultural produce is exported, much of it to Europe. In Australia, that's not the case. So to take an example, in 2014, over 60% of New Zealand's apple harvest was exported. In Australia, it was between 1% and 2%. And this has important implications for the labour market. High-value export markets put external pressures on employers to meet quality standards through compliance with a sourcing code of quality and employer conduct. Without that pressure in Australia, the same hasn't occurred. And in fact, Richard Curtin has made the argument that in Australia, the Coles Woolworths duopoly has effectively had the opposite effect because the focus... the impact of that duopoly has been to put pricing pressure on suppliers, that's very well established, and that has really driven down wages in the sector. A second explanation for the comparative success of the New Zealand scheme relates to its regulatory regime. So choosing the more regulated option means paying the minimum required wage. The minimum wage in New Zealand is considerably lower than in Australia. It's around $14, whereas in Australia, if you take into account the casual loading, which is typically paid, it's around $22. Also on enforcement, on regulation, I mentioned this earlier, enforcement has tended to be stronger in New Zealand. And it's worth noting that when the RSC scheme was introduced in New Zealand, before that occurred, there was a strong crackdown on illegal labour in the horticulture industry. I've already talked about this third point. In Australia, the second year visa extension provided to backpackers has provided an incentive for backpackers to work in horticulture. That's not a financial incentive. So backpackers are willing to accept low pay to work in the horticulture sector simply so they can continue to reside in Australia for an additional year. Hasn't happened in New Zealand. And the timing of these changes was important. So the introduction of that second year extension occurred before the seasonal worker program was established in Australia. In New Zealand, the order was the opposite. So the RSC scheme was already well established, already had thousands of workers coming to New Zealand before that extension was put in place. So timing mattered, in other words. There was a certain hysteresis or path dependency. A final explanation for the comparative success of the New Zealand scheme relates to Australia's attractiveness as a backpacker destination and also to the fact that New Zealand has a much larger Pacific diaspora. Not all participants in the RSC are Pacific Islanders, but a good proportion are, between 70% and 80%. So I brushed through that a little bit because of the technical mishaps at the start, but I guess to conclude, a regulated, low-skilled migration program has been successful in New Zealand, but it has struggled to gain traction in Australia, and we explain this different outcome in terms of four explanations. There are two implications from our findings for the broader literature. First, going back to that crowding out hypothesis, which argues that poorly regulated temporary migration schemes will crowd out better regulated ones. From our analysis, that argument is overly simplistic. There's no guarantee that will be the case, and it really depends on a whole range of factors that are specific to both the country and to the sector. The second implication, though, which I want to raise, is relevant to policymakers, and that is that preference for regulated labour will depend on a wide range of factors, and some of those are amenable to policy changes. So the importance of the change to the working holiday visa in Australia demonstrates this very clearly. If that change had not occurred, I very likely wouldn't be giving this presentation. And what that means is that while right now Australian horticulture supports the crowding out hypothesis, it's not inconceivable that won't be the case in the future. It could join New Zealand on the other side of the ledger. For that to happen, though, there needs to be change in the Australian migration program. In order that it better support the seasonal worker program, there have been some positive changes in recent years. Rob mentioned the uncapping of the seasonal worker program. The taxation of backpackers also puts seasonal workers on a better footing relative to their competitors. But more changes are needed for Australia to emulate the New Zealand experience. I'll finish there. Thank you.
Great, thanks so much, Matt, and the other authors. I mean, that really was a fantastic overview and a great way to start the session. There are so many myths and misconceptions around the two schemes, and it was great to have not just the two put together, but with some crunchy policy conclusions to take away at the end. Okay, so now we're going to jump from sort of our own sort of context and have a look at a different but related one, which is the experience of Timorese migrant workers in the UK. So I'd like to welcome Anne Wigglesworth to the stage and just try and get your presentation up.
Okay. Thank you. To start with a nice picture of Dungannon. And those of you who don't know Dungannon, Most people in Timor have heard of it. It's probably got the biggest population of Timorese of any town in Europe. So I started doing some work on migration last year, particularly looking at Timorese in Korea, and through the ANU Pacific Possible Program, and have since gone on to do more work in that area. I'm a development background, interested in migration as a development strategy, and then I've also the fact that although there's two official migration programs in Timor, the biggest number go to UK. So that just briefly explains the work I've been working with Cardinal also on seasonal workers, and I did this work on the works in Korea just because the numbers are so big. So while Timor has sent 1,800 people to Korea over 6 years, and there's been 600 workers go to Australia over 4 years. In Timor, we're talking about an estimate of the current population in UK is 16,000. So it's very huge, and it's self-managed. It's not an official program. And they go there because they can get Portuguese passports. Anyone who was born before the year 2000 is eligible for Portuguese passport, and then they go on the EU. So it started back in 2000 when apparently, as the story goes, there was a labour contractor from Portugal, from Northern Ireland, went to Portugal to recruit workers and ended up with the Timorese. And then he told his friends, and they've been going ever since. And it follows family patterns and friendships. So people go to where they know people from their village or from their family, and it has become a really major source of income for Timorese. Just to show you, it's not very good, I'm not a very good map, I'm afraid, but the main areas, this is Dungannon here, Cookstown and Portadown also got quite big populations of Timorese, and this is the area, the industrial area, and it's mostly meat factories actually. So I did this small study in two phases. One was in Timor, in Dili. I interviewed people who had actually been and come back from UK, and I also was in Northern Ireland and interviewed a number of workers who were actually there at that time. And for this study, I'm using a theoretical framework, which is looking at positioning theories, looking at understanding how people present themselves, understand their place in society, and how they use discourse to locate themselves actually influences the outcomes that they have. So I think it's a very interesting approach to this. Just quickly, 14 male, 5 female, there were 19 total I interviewed, majority of them between 30 and 49. And the majority of them also had university education. And they had been various lengths of time, as you see in the UK, but some of them up to 14 years. And a lot of them had been considerably longer than they're able to stay in Korea, which is a sort of 3 to 5 year framework. There tend to be very long periods that they stay there, which I'll talk about a bit later. Dungannon Meat Factory employed 600 workers, of whom a third are Timorese. And Moy Park Chicken Factory employs 1,800, of whom 800 are Timorese. So we're talking big numbers. As a consequence of that, of course, they are living and working in Timorese community and often don't learn English. They sort of say, well, we They know the British don't like working, doing this sort of work, but for them it's not a problem. But in England, and there's a lot of different places in England where they're working, and they're more likely to work as kitchen hands in a restaurant, one of them Chinese or Thai restaurants, in a warehouse, supermarket, as cleaners or food processing factories as well. Much more diverse in the UK than it is in Ireland. So they go to where they have family and friends, they stay with these family and friends while looking for work. Sometimes it's quite a long time before they get work. Quite often they get part-time work and then have to wait until a position comes available that they can move into a full-time job. And a lot of people have talked about the very poor conditions that they live in, but this is a highly variable. I mean, I met people who said there were like a dozen people in the house and they crammed four into a bedroom to reduce the rent, but I met others who said, I have my own house and, I want to live in a decent way. So how they choose to use the money or send it home is very variable. And most of them do move around to improve their working options. They all said that their treatment by employers was very good, and they all said that the official system does not discriminate against them. They were very clear that the system, they have to do the sign on to national insurance, they can get some benefits from that, that they all are treated the same. But where they did complain about exploitation was by their supervisors, and they had the number of them were criticising the behaviour of Eastern European supervisors in them specific countries, and had a lot of problems as a result of that. Interestingly, none of the team members I interviewed, a small sample, it's just to say they don't happen, but even though there'd been 8-14 years in a factory, they had never risen up to a supervisory level. And one of the reasons is that they had, quite a lot of them had very poor English, some of them had a little bit of English. So their contact with others was highly restricted, and they all lived with other teenagers. But in England, that was a little bit different because they tended to have better English. Because they tended not to be in such large Timorese type community. Now, I just want to look at some of the family arrangements. I think it's really interesting. And I've got some case studies, which I won't have time to go into in detail. But so I guess a majority of them would have left spouse and children at home. That's both male and female. There were a number of women who did that. There were other workers who went there, and then after a number of years, they brought their spouse and kids to UK. I met two workers, or two pairs of workers, who'd arrived single and actually met and married at other Timorese while they were in UK and were staying there. There were single workers, and there were workers whose children were actually born in UK, which actually put a very different light on how they saw themselves. So, I won't go into detail, but this guy Roberto, he'd been there for 8 years and had his family at home. He was very homesick, actually. He wanted to go back, but he couldn't because he had to finish paying for the education of his, I can't remember, siblings or cousins or whoever they were, the family members that he was supporting. So a lot of people get kind of stuck, and of course there's no regulatory framework that says when they how long they can stay, so they can stay as long or as short as they like, unlike in the other worker program, the Korea and Australia ones. So a number of them did say, well, I have to have this commitment, we have to pay off this or pay for the education of someone or finish, get enough money to build my house or buy some land so I can build a house when I get back. So that was often the way they that kept them there. Also, I mean, this guy, Fidelis, he was interesting because he had a better level of education. He'd actually come from Portugal, and he learned, he became an interpreter, and through that work as an interpreter, he both increased his status in the place, as well as his income. Women who came, they lived, sometimes leave behind children for many years. They're looked after by the family. They're not worried about it. They say, that's fine. They're perfectly okay with the family. This one also was a social service. So I really want to... I'll just move through this. I don't think we want to go into all of this. But there's... The analysis, many Tingray's workers felt their only reason for being in UK to earn money and send remittances to their family. And most of those did monthly. They're mostly working as unskilled workers, and some of them have got degrees. And many don't learn good English. And so they are really living there as part of the migrant community. And... the ones who did it learn English, some of them did then start mixing with British workmates, neighbours, and they were quite, they felt very positive about their relationship with other people in the community, and they were much more comfortable about staying and so on. And then there were other workers who had their families in the UK, and some of them who actually were born in the UK. And that was a real game changer in terms of their future, because once the kids were going to school in the UK, the kids became the grounding. They were no longer sending the remittances home, they were spending the money on the kids, and the kids on the whole don't want to return to Timor, and some of them had never been to Timor. It was just there in the background. The other side of the migration issue is how migrants are seen from the community, and that's also important in how people feel about, you know, what they're doing, where they are. And so many arrive in the early period to face discrimination as Catholics because they're in Northern Ireland. There's a conflict going on between Catholics and Protestants, and they were caught up in that. But that's over now. And but there have been a series of incidents that have been in the papers. I mean, I've been seeing a few media reports that have involved Timorese, and that has created a sort of negative impression and lack of local laws and so on. I probably haven't got that. I just wanted to talk about this family who is a really six of them. This guy has been there for 14 years, doesn't speak English. That young boy was he was a baby when he came to England, and the other ones were brought over, they were partly educated. So they've all got really different positioning in terms of their status in the UK community, you know, as unskilled migrant workers. The older ones who came over, who were mostly educated in Timor, have learned some English. They're working there as migrant workers, but now they've got higher level skills. Like one of them's in a job in a car factory, so he's, you know, taken on a much better job than his father's capable of having. Then there's two middle school ones who are basically, I mean, they've been educated in the British system, and they will have similar capabilities to English educated. And then the two very young ones who actually don't have any memories of Timor at all, and you know, their parents don't imagine them going back. So the positioning theory is one that, you know, it looks at how people achieve different positions in society, from starting in the assembly line, and then, you know, how they're able to move through into more into different positions in society. So in conclusion, it offers a big opportunity for improving the economic situation of the family at home. The Timorese communities that work together and support each other, that, I mean, that's really powerful. And like one of them died and they have a sort of run around to get money to help repatriate the body. So they really work together as a community. And I saw that, the insular. But what they told me was that the ones who had less English were most likely to get in trouble with the law and most likely to face discrimination. And the migrants with kids in the UK tend to focus their lives on the welfare of the children. And all of the migrant workers wanted to return to Timor, not their children, but all of the migrant workers, and saw life in the UK as a means to an end rather than the destination they wanted to be. But their kids wanted to stay because of the greater opportunities. So, okay, that's.
Okay, thanks so much, Anne. Okay, so I've gone from the big picture and the macro numbers to some really personal stories there. I was fascinated also, I think from a policy perspective, you touched on Korea there as well, and that's something I know the ADB has looked at as part of the opportunity. We can gravitate towards looking at Australia and New Zealand, but, you know, the opportunities of migration for Pacific Islanders into Asia is also something. I think expect a question on Brexit when it comes to it. So we're running well for time, I think. So we'll have about 25 minutes for questions, so please line them up. But now I'd like to welcome Elise, who's going to talk about some of the development impacts of labour mobility in the Pacific.
Good afternoon, everyone. Firstly, I'd just like to take this opportunity to thank Stephen Howes and the Development Policy Centre for the opportunity to share my research with you. As you all know, labour mobility is very crucial to the Pacific, and so as a Pacific Islander, I'm definitely very grateful to share my research with you. My research is on the development impact of labour mobility in Pacific sending countries, using Tonga's participation in the Australian Seasonal Worker Program as a case study. As you all know, Tonga is a small, lower middle income country in the Pacific, population of around 100,000, land area 720 square kilometers, GDP of about $720 million. Real GDP growth has actually been relatively low over the past decade or so, an average of 0.7%, which is lower than the average of 5.8% for Southeast Asian countries and lower than the 2.4% average for Pacific Island countries. This low rate of growth has contributed to the low labor participation rate of 52.3%. It's considered one of the lowest in the Pacific. Where the growing working age population of Tonga are unable to find employment. For small countries like Tonga, international trade and regional integration is very crucial for sustainable economic development. But as you can see from this graph, exports have actually accounted for an average of about just 16% over the past two decades. When in contrast, we look at remittances, it has contributed about 26% to GDP. You can say if we consider remittances as the returns for the export of labor, perhaps labor mobility is the most important export industry for Tonga. When you compare remittances to other capital flows, such as FDI and aid, it is very obvious that perhaps remittances is the most important capital flow for Tonga. Tonga has access to two main temporary labor migration programs, mainly to Australia and New Zealand, under the Australian Seasonal Worker Program and the New Zealand Recognized Employment Scheme. Under the Seasonal Worker Program, and this is particularly important for low-skilled workers who otherwise would not have access to labor migration opportunities. Under the Seasonal Worker Program, Tonga has been the main source country since the inception of the program in 2008, even though in the past year or so, Vanuatu has picked up very quickly. These programs have contributed substantially to growth in remittances. As you can see from this graph, the Australian program has been, remittances from the Australian program has been the fastest growing compared to the New Zealand one. the research strategy that I am using, as I mentioned, I'm using a case study of Thomas participation in the SWP. I adopt a mixed methods research strategy using surveys of about 520 SWP households and migrants, and some interviews of about 85 stakeholders, both in Taiwan and Australia. From the research, we've identified that migrant households export or send their workers to Australia through the seasonal worker program, and in return for this export, the returns to Tonga are in remittances that the migrants transfer, and the skills that are acquired by the migrants while they were in Australia. The research, however, identified that all migrants actually transfer their remittances directly to their households. And the skills acquired by the migrants whilst they were in Australia, unless they are actually transferred in Tonga, they remain as unutilized private household assets. So my research proposes that the development impact of the SWP would be contingent on the extent to which migrant households actually transfer the remittances and the skills received from the SWP for the productive capacity development of the Tongan economy through labor, the supply of labor and skills, savings, and entrepreneurship or investment in self-enterprises. Based on the research, just looking at the use of remittances, it was very clear, as you can see from that table, that there's very high marginal propensity for consumption, to consume. The key priorities for migrants are in the basic needs for households: food, education, payment of utility bills, housing, and vehicles. Savings and investment are very much down in terms of priority. In terms of skill transfers, 86% of the migrant sample indicated that they had acquired a new skill, mainly in the use of new machinery, working long hours — these are people that were mostly unemployed in Tonga — and new planting methods. None of the migrants actually indicated that these new skills were actually transferred in Tonga in terms of alternative income-generating activities. My research went on further to identify, under the status quo, that is, without government intervention, what has been the impact of the seasonal worker program on household entrepreneurship, labor participation, and savings. In terms of household entrepreneurship, which is investment in self-enterprises, only 9.3% invested in some kind of self-enterprises, mostly small-scale commercial agriculture and handicraft businesses. It was interesting to note, however, that an additional 40% were very willing to invest but did not know how, which is very identical to what the Korean study identified. In terms of the impact on household savings, only 28.9% of households indicated that they had saved a percentage of their remittances. Within this 28.9%, 70 households began saving after their participation in the program. It was interesting to note, however, that about 71.1% of these households are not actually included in the local financial system. And it's interesting also to note that these savings were mainly for future consumption. It was not for investment. In terms of labor participation, 93.9% of the household sample indicated that there was no impact, which means that the majority of SWP households in Tonga are solely dependent on the SWP for the livelihoods of their households. This poses high risks on the sustainable livelihoods of these households in the incident that these migrants would not continue working in the program, or in the noting that migrants tend to retire from the program after 7 to 8 years of participation. It was also identified from the research that there was an adverse impact on household labor participation. 5% indicated that there was an increase in voluntary employment, where they intentionally decided to delay their decision to find employment. There was also — the interviews with the private sector indicated that there were losses of low-skilled labor, particularly for the agricultural export sector, the construction sector, and some of the services sector. this is not just only because of the migration of workers under the seasonal worker program, but some of the people that have participated in the program, mainly the males, they have encouraged their wives who work in Tonga to actually stay back and take care of their households. So this, there is consideration, and there, this was raised quite substantially by the agricultural sector and the construction sector, saying that it has affected their productivity, and mainly because of the increased cost of labor. Based on these findings, my research submits that there are inefficiencies which require government intervention. And one area that my research proposes for government intervention is in the area of reintegration. And this is not just to reintegrate or re-include workers, but it's a program that could facilitate household income diversification. This would not only enhance the development impact of the SPP, but would also address the issues regarding the issues with the livelihoods of households. The focus on households, the research identified that this is the decision-making unit in Tonga in terms of household income diversification. Based on this research, some of the key components that were identified. Number one, access to finance. There was an identified need for increased access to existing development, government development self-loans for investment. There was also a need for savings products to encourage savings. There was interest from the migrants, which was interesting to me, for government to facilitate automated deductions from the workers' wages for investment. And these are products that need to be designed and tailored to the needs of the migrants themselves. Another key constraint that was identified from the research was skills development. Both the employers and the workers indicated that the current add-on skills training and pre-departure trainings currently available under the seasonal worker program cannot facilitate household income diversification. They indicated there is a need to link the program to TVET skills training. Another key gap was the lack of business support services, particularly for SME businesses. This is, according to the interviews with the private sector, the households that have invested in self-enterprises, the problem is not so much the lack of investment opportunities, it's the lack of information. There needs to be information on what kind of investment opportunities are available, and there needs to be supportive services provided to facilitate that investment. Women play a very important role. The majority of over 70% of the households interviewed, surveyed, indicated that the remittances received by the households are actually managed by women. And so therefore, there is a need for these women to be trained on how to use those remittances. They are actually not included in the current trainings under the SWP. There was also very substantial interest in collective entrepreneurship. This is perhaps reflective of the collective culture of Tonga and the Pacific Islands, and cooperatives in the 60s and 70s actually drove economic development in Tonga. So this is an area that perhaps needs to be reconsidered to support household income diversification. There was also a very important role that was identified from the interviews with the diaspora communities here in Australia, that they too can also play an important role. They can facilitate exports. They can actually be partners in potential joint ventures with investments in Tonga. This is something actually that has not been explored within the investment policies in Tonga. And so these are some of the components that were identified from the research which needs to be addressed in terms of policy to facilitate household income diversification. To develop such a program, however, requires foreign aid, and it's quickly obvious when you look at the budget appropriations for labor mobility and SME development in Tonga. I personally believe, based on the research, that foreign aid should also help to increase the capacity of the Tongan government and stakeholders to manage and implement these programs, and that ownership should be, that they should take ownership of this program for it to be actually effective. I'd like to conclude by just quoting a statement from Prime Minister Turnbull's statement in the last Pacific Islands Forum leaders meeting last year. He stated, "My government recognizes that Australia's interests in the region and the complexity of the challenges we face demands more engagement at every level, more integrated policy, and fresh ideas. We are committed to a step change in our engagement." I could not be more supportive of this statement, and I believe that one area that we could consider for this step change is something that innovative measures to actually enhance the development impact of labor mobility in the Pacific Island countries, and perhaps one of them would be a household income diversification program. Thank you.